HYY.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Amanda Hess received a number of threatening tweets from someone who called himself Headless Female Pig. The messages were disgusting and degrading and scary, threatening rape and death. She wrote about what happened to her and other women who have been stalked and threatened online in an article in Pacific Standard magazine. Turns out women are much more likely to face harassment and abuse on the internet than men. Today on Radio Times, what can be done about it? How should internet harassers be held accountable for their behavior? And we have two guests, including Amanda Hess, a staff writer at Slate, joins us from the studios of Slate. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us, Danielle Citron. She's a professor of law at the University of Maryland, Francis King Carey School of Law. She has a book coming out later this year, in fact, in the summer, called Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Danielle Citron, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. Amanda, let me begin with you and even begin where I began this interview and this introduction. What triggered those tweets? Do you know?
Wow. I mean, I could not say. It's the sort of thing that I receive a lot and I've sort of gotten since I started writing on the internet. And, you know, from talking to other women, I think it's just our basic presence online that seems to threaten or bother some people.
And is it because of what you're writing about, what you're talking about online?
I don't think so. I mean, I happen to write about issues that I think get a lot of people upset, like feminism and women's issues and sexuality. But I've spoken to women who write about politics, who write about any number sort of things, food or sports, and many of them sort of receive similar types of threats.
You write about you calling the cops, calling the police when feeling threatened. What was their response?
So this has happened a couple of times, but the most recent time that I received threats over the internet, I called the police in Palm Springs, which is where I happened to be at the time that I received them. And, you know, just a regular officer came to my hotel room. I explained to him what happened, and his response was, "What is Twitter?" Mm. He was not aware of the platform where this was happening. And from there, it became clear that because these things were happening online, you know, on the one hand, the police maybe didn't understand them, didn't understand why they might have any sort of real-world effect on me. And also, it made it easier for them to dismiss and sort of get on with their day.
Let me go to you, Danielle Citron. Does it surprise you that women are more likely to face harassments and threats online than men?
You know, it's been documented empirically and then through my work in talking to so many victims of online harassment. Several studies, recent studies, show that over, you know, 80% of the victims of online harassment are female. So it's not surprising at all. So it's, I think, both the identity of the victims and the message that's being sent, so that, you know, what we see is that the harassment isn't just threatening violence, but it's threatening sexual violence. And it's sexually degrading so often. So accusing someone of having sort of sexually transmitted infections or being a prostitute, a whore. I mean, we think of the kind of threats that Amanda faced, sort of graphic sexualized threats that seem like imminent. You know, the intent of causing imminent violence and are frightening. So it's, you know, Amanda's story is just, it exemplifies the kind of thing we're seeing online.
Amanda, did you or do you or have you at times felt like a victim? Danielle used the word victim, victim of harassment. Have you felt that way?
I think I just am because, you know, the threats that were made against me are criminal. And so I don't really have a choice to decide whether I'm a victim or not. I just am one. But it is true that it's very difficult to sort of know how to feel about these threats. Mm-hmm. When I received them, I talked with a lot of friends about it and colleagues and sort of got two different responses. One was people who thought it was very serious, who wanted me to investigate them and try to get whoever sent them, you know, into court.
Right.
And to protect myself in case, you know, anything sort of ended up threatening me in my real life. And then there were other people who said, you know, it's just the internet. It's unlikely that he's going to come, you know, rape and behead you as he has promised. And you should just ignore them.
Well, and that's such a, you know, that's such a difficult choice, Danielle Citron, about, you know, how to deal with a threat. If it happened out in the quote-unquote real world, if what was said to Amanda was said to her on the street, how would law enforcement behave?
You know, I can't guarantee that they would do or act any better than they do, but it's absolutely true that because it appears online and isn't in a letter that they can tangibly see, that so often the response is, oh, it's no big deal, just turn your computer off, you can ignore it. You know, no one will actually come, cause you physical harm. But the truth of the matter is, when we think about threat laws, why do we criminalize it? We criminalize it because of the kind of disruption it causes for people. That you change the way you live your life, that you are constantly looking over your shoulder. And it's been shown that, you know, when people receive threats online, that it's actually much more troubling to individuals because they just don't know where the threat comes from. So if it were face-to-face, you could see the person is shorter than you are, they don't seem menacing, and have a sort of joking appearance, or you can escape them, you know how to escape them. But when it's online, you just don't know that the person who's threatening you could be 5 seconds away from your house or 5 states away.
Or halfway around the world.
So disturbing.
Yeah, Amanda, you even describe having voicemail threats and essentially having a stalker who was after you.
Yeah, you know, that was a sort of a different situation because right. It was someone who I knew who they were, but they were sort of carrying out the harassment online and over the phone. And in that case, I was able to take a lot of time out of work and some money to serve him with a protection order and get a protection order for a year. In this case, because I didn't know who it was who was threatening me and because the police wouldn't investigate it, if they had, we could have figured out at least where they were and if they had, any sort of personal information tied to their Twitter account. I don't know if he's the same person or a different person, could be living down the street from me or very far away. And so because the police said that we didn't know that, they wouldn't take the steps to figure out, to actually figure out what the answers were in those cases.
And Danielle, is it, the speaking broadly here, that police departments just haven't kind of caught up with Twitter, haven't caught up with social media, don't quite understand it, so they don't know what they're dealing with?
I think that's absolutely right. So part of the problem and why we see the response of, just turn your computer off, it's no big deal, or just don't use Twitter, which is some of what, Amanda heard from officers, is that they don't get the technology and the resources aren't being spent to train them on how integrally important these different services are to doing people's work. I mean, Amanda is a journalist who makes a living, so I don't want to speak for you, Amanda, but sure. I've read your work for many years, and it's, you make a living by spreading your ideas online, by blogging, right, by communicating through Slate and other kind of outlets. And so we can't say to someone like Amanda, hey, turn your Twitter account off. But it's true that law enforcement, suffers from kind of an ignorance of the importance of these tools and then how to figure out how to sort of track down perpetrators when it's just frankly not that difficult. But we have to spend the time and money training officers both about the nature of harassment and threat laws, as well as just how to handle the technology.
Amanda, have you had to or had the impulse to self-censor because you felt what you might be writing or saying would provoke someone to send you a ugly tweet?
No, because the people who are sending these things are obviously not totally rational actors. No. I can't predict what will make someone, want me to die. It's a ridiculous notion. Although I do know that because of, some of the volume that people get, whether they're someone who has an online platform or they're just someone who's, using the internet for dating, it does turn some women off. And if they, some might choose not to pursue a career online. At this point, that's not really a choice for me. I sort of have to do it, and so it doesn't even really enter my mind.
You write about yourself, but you also write about other journalists who have gotten similar responses, and also the fact that, regular folks, people that don't live a kind of public life the way you do, have also had to face the kind of threats and harassment that you had, Amanda.
That's true. I heard from any number of different types of women in the U.S. and around the world, and it is something that, I think you can sort of read news stories about it happening to people like me or other journalists, celebrities, anyone in the public eye. Mm-hmm. But it's also really happening to women who have, you know, as you said, they have very little public profiles. And they're often crimes that are, you know, sort of happening in concert, in person and online. So I heard from women who were being stalked by ex-boyfriends, people that they knew, and came to the police with all of this evidence in the form of emails and YouTube videos that their ex-boyfriends were using to harass them. And it used to be that police would see a situation like that and say, it's a he said, she said situation. We have no evidence to sort of prosecute someone.
Right.
But now there's all of this evidence, but because it's happening online, it's often dismissed as less than real, which I think is very confusing and depressing.
To you, Danielle, and this has been said about the internet, one of the wonderful things about the internet is its anonymity, and one of the terrible things about the internet is its anonymity. Do you think the anonymity kind of feeds the ability of someone to harass somebody else?
So I want to echo, you know, what you said, that anonymity is an incredibly important value. It, you know, it allows the domestic violence victim to have voice online who she couldn't write in her own name or the political dissenter. But you're right that in some sense it brings out the best and the worst in us, anonymity. So it's been sort of empirically shown that when we feel like we can't be identified, and it's true, even online when we're using our real names and screen names that can be traced to us, we often act on destructive impulses because we feel anonymous, right? When we're using, like when we don't see people directly in front of us. And so we're just more likely to act on destructive impulses. Does that then lead to the sort of resolution that we should just get rid of anonymity online? Mm-hmm. And I would say absolutely not. That we need to make, these are really difficult choices. We have hard choices to make and we have to balance really important interests. And that anonymity is not something we should sort of sacrifice, that it's a kind of a problem that we have to get at it so many different ways. Part of it is like the first step that Amanda did was writing this piece, talking about it, getting journalists to have and help us understand this is a problem, right? Because when victims who are most often not the public figure, who are the ordinary private citizen whose response to this abuse is going to be absolutely to go offline, I've talked to victims who've changed their names because their online reputations of their former name has totally destroyed. Mm. So that they sort of move, go undercover, change their names. And when they go to law enforcement, the response is, you know, either the laws, they're not familiar with them, they can't figure out who the defendants are, and they say, that's a civil matter. You know, go sue your perpetrator. And it's incredibly expensive to sue. And you see people truly retreat, lose their jobs, become unemployable in a way that we've got to grapple with it.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation talking about women on the web, online harassment, revenge porn, the debate over civil rights protections on the internet. That's Danielle Citron, and she's a professor of law at the University of Maryland. Amanda Hess, also with us as well, a staff writer at Slate. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. What should we do about this? We'll be right back.
Allentown Symphony Orchestra supports WHYY and presents Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, Saturday, April 5th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, April 6th at 3 p.m., featuring young Croatian pianist Martina Filijak. Winner of the Cleveland International Piano Competition, Martina brings her poetic passion and technical mastery at the keyboard. Also on the program, Wagner's Prelude to Act 3 of Lohengrin and Strauss's Ein Heldenleben. For information, millersymphonyhall.org.
Steve, let me ask you something. When you're hosting NPR's Morning Edition, how do you keep all those news stories straight in your head?
By listening. I don't pretend to know all the answers. My job is to know who to ask and how to ask them. At NPR's Morning Program, our job is to push for real stories, honest answers.
And you can listen with us on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, need food or shelter? In San Francisco, there's an app for that, and the homeless are using it on their cell phones.
Well, there are several programs that allow homeless people in the nation to acquire cell phones with a limited amount of voice and unlimited amount of text.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about what to do about online harassment. And as it turns out, women face much more harassment online than men do. Amanda Hess experienced it firsthand, wrote about it in the Pacific Standard magazine. She's a staff writer at Slate. Also with us, Danielle Citron. She's a law professor at the University of Maryland. We have calls coming in. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Amanda, let me go back to you because you and others have written about a guy who was outed. His Twitter name was Violentacres, and he was outed. Turns out he's a man named Michael Brush. Brush. Tell us, I guess, what he was doing and who he turned out to be in real life.
So he was a sort of notorious Reddit poster. He would go to this website. If you're not familiar with it, Reddit is, it calls itself the homepage of the internet, and it's a collection of communities of people talking about different topics. And the topics that he would talk about tended to be horrible. So he would, moderate topics about rape, moderate threads that were dedicated to taking photographs of underage girls when they were not aware of it and sharing them, sort of making sexual comments about their bodies. And he became a very controversial figure in Reddit, both because a lot of Reddit users felt that what he was doing was not acceptable. But there's also an ethos there toward, protecting speech and keeping people anonymous. So a reporter with Gawker, Adrian Chen, found out who this guy was, and he wrote a story about, what his real life is like, and he used his name and he sort of revealed that he was just a regular computer programmer who lived in Texas. And when Adrian talked with Michael, the sort of man behind the troll, his sort of explanation for why he was doing all these things that many people thought were vile was that it was just a game to him, and he was sort of bored, and he sort of felt that he led a boring life, and when he went home, he just wanted to sort of go onto Reddit and post photos of girls like people, go home and play video games or watch television.
Well, in fact, I wrote down a couple of his explanations about what he was doing. And one is, I just liked riling people up in my spare time. And then he also says people take things way too seriously around here. Let me go back to you, Danielle Citron. And I mean, how should we understand this person?
And what's so interesting, too, is let me just add another explanation that he gave, which shows just how the Internet brings out kind of the best and worst in us. He said, he felt really encouraged by all the kind of thumbs up he was getting from the sort of props from other users for his service. And he felt like he was sort of pleasing the crowd, that he felt, important because he was making them feel, he was feeling important because others were kind of applauding what he was doing. And I think of it as kind of creative destruction, that we will move to greater extremes because people, when they kind of affirm our destruction, they push us to even be more extreme, right? So it's a phenomenon called like group polarization. And we see it like cyber mobs that snowball and attack victims that become even more destructive. Like everyone's trying to one-up each other. But the truth of the matter is for individuals who are featured in those creep shots, the nude images, they suffer, right? So if they're identified to their photos, it's the employers who see them, right? They suffer deep embarrassment while everyone else, as Amanda said, thinks of it as a game in which we can kind of one-up each other and win. So it's disturbing, of course, and it has real-world consequences.
I think they also call that the bystander effect, the effect that bystanders can have on someone's behavior. But even turning that on its head, Amanda, it's also possible to organize people to go after people like Michael Brush and to use the power of the Internet against them.
That is certainly possible. This is actually a solution that some people have furthered for this problem, which is that we just need to fight fire with fire,
right,
and to not only sort of reveal these people for who they are, but also, you know, in some cases, some people think that we should harass them back. I'm not sure that that is an ultimate sort of tenable solution. I think that, you know, there are these huge institutions, law enforcement and technology companies that are really complicit in this problem. And I don't think it's sort of fair to ask victims to take on this new real job of sort of taking on vigilante justice in this case.
Well,
but it's certainly an interesting phenomenon.
It certainly is. Daniel, let me just pick up on that and go back to you then. So, and we're talking about speech here, and obviously scary, threatening speech as well. Is it the user who's responsible? Is it the service provider? Is it the police? I mean, who has jurisdiction when we're talking about something like this?
Right. So it's in terms of jurisdiction, like who is responsible for this kind of speech? Of course, it's the perpetrators, but who should deal with it?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly intermediaries, you know, the platforms are private parties. So they're not government actors who are bound by the First Amendment, and they can freely choose to do nothing. They can decide this is not the kind of speech we want on our platform and we want to moderate. So they are free to do what they want with this kind of speech. And there are many intermediaries who kind of view themselves as, we want to shape user norms. We want to encourage, you know, communities of civility. We don't want to have this kind of speech on our sites. There are others who kind of view themselves as free speech platforms, and their choice, as is their choice, to do nothing. When it comes to speech, that is tantamount to true threats, or speech inciting, you know, imminent violence like solicitation, defamation, we said, you know what, law can step in. I think, you know, Amanda's response to your initial question about, you know, should we take this on our own? Should we use self-help? What I see is sort of a one-way ratchet to degradation. Like, it becomes cyber mobs on both sides of the coin, if indeed victims can get people to support them. And then what happens is there's an even greater backlash against victims and their supporters. They become harassed as well. And it is absolutely not the route we want to go down. It's very treacherous and dangerous for victims, certainly.
And let me just add, because we're talking about things that, frankly, I can't say on the radio in terms of what was said to you, Amanda Hess. I mean, it's a kind of language that, you know, is impermissible on broadcast, but obviously lives, anyone that goes on the net, you bump into these words all the time. Sadly.
Yeah.
I'm not promoting it. I'm just saying there it is.
Right. I mean, you know, I think I should say there are a lot of things that we can't say on the radio, and it's not just that these were sort of swear words.
No, they're not swear
words.
They're
very targeted, you know, at my body and, you know, sort of like bringing up imagery of rape and beheading and stuff like that.
Right.
You know, I agree with Danielle that it's something that can sort of proliferate online in a way that it maybe couldn't before. But I also feel like this impulse to leverage power over women through their bodies or through sexual violence is obviously, you know, as old as time. And we're just seeing a sort of new iteration of this happening on the internet, which is one thing that's so depressing about it, is that this is, you know, a problem that we've dealt with through the law. You know, we've dealt with sexual harassment in the workplace. We've dealt with domestic violence through special legislation. And now that we have this new platform, I think police and legislators have been a little bit slow to figure out how to deal with it there.
Let me pick up on that. And then I do want to get to our callers. To you, Danielle, is it that we need new laws, or we need to understand how to apply the laws that we already have?
Right. So it's definitely a combination. I mean, what we're seeing is the same exact patterns that society's inattention and minimization of the kind of harms that we saw in the 60s and 70s for sexual harassment in the workplace, where we said, it's no big deal, just leave your work, you'll be fine. And, you know, Amar responded. It's true that there are laws on the books that we can enforce today, so that can be brought to bear against this kind of abuse. the legal project isn't like the one that we had in the 70s where we say, oh my goodness, we have to completely kind of, in some respects, create new law or reinterpret law that we haven't understood as covering sexually hostile environments. I mean, in the same way, there are laws existing that we can interpret and apply against this kind of abuse, and there are gaps in the law that we need to fill in. So, for example, harassment laws often only apply to direct communications to victims. But so often, the communications aren't direct, right? The revenge porn poster who puts up naked images of someone online with next to someone's home address and the suggestion the person's interested in sex, that's not sent to the victim.
Right.
It's posted online, and strangers read it and confront them online, offline, right? So that harassment laws need to be, in some sense, updated for the 21st century in ways that they won't get outmoded with changing technologies.
Well, let me quickly reintroduce the two of you and also just remind our listeners, we're talking about online harassment, a revenge porn, the debate over rights, responsibilities, and protections on the Internet. Danielle Citrin, the voice you just heard, is a professor of law at the University of Maryland, Francis King Carey School of Law, and she has a book coming out this summer called Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, to be published by Harvard University Press. Amanda Hess is a staff writer at Slate covering, and I'm quoting here, ladies, culture, and technology. And we have been talking about some of what she has experienced online, and we want to hear from you. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet as well, @WHYY Radio Times, and tell us what you think, if anything, should be done about this. Let me get, looks like Richard from Westchester to join our conversation. Hi, Richard. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to propose the notion that perhaps these social media have some kind of an unanticipated transformative effect on our personalities. We just really never quite expected, and we become, in a sense, somewhat different animals when we're using them. And my own example of that in my own life is I hardly ever use social media at all, but all of a sudden I discovered, hey, I could get in touch with this person who's from the past, because I happen to have some photographs of their family that they may be interested in, and maybe they would really appreciate having them. So I sent this email out through Facebook, which I never had previously used, and all of a sudden, I started writing in a manner that I never wrote in before. I just got zany and carried away and weird. And the person understandably never wrote back to me.
Right.
And now when I look back at those communications, I'm embarrassed by them. I look at them, I'm saying, what became, what came over me? How did I write that stuff? So maybe we've just created something here that is somewhat uncontrollable and, monsterish.
Well, Richard, I appreciate the call, and I want to give both of our guests a chance to respond, but let me just say from my own perspective is that we are responsible for what we do, even if we're embarrassed about it or if we take on another persona, it's still us. Amanda Hess, I'd be curious about your response.
Yeah, I mean, I think that our whole society is sort of going through the process that Richard himself went through, starting, with the internet as this place that, was a wild, different place. You sort of see movies, early movies about the internet where it's this, like, rushing wall of ones and zeros and stuff like that.
I remember that,
really,
actually.
Yeah, it was this place that was divorced from our lives, and I think a lot of people thought it would be a place where we could maybe create new identities that are different from our own. And perhaps it still is that, but it's also, really sort of evolving to be a part of just our lives in general. And so even though people sort of act differently in different scenarios, at least for me, all of my social networks are really tied to my sort of professional persona. And it's sort of second nature to me now. And also, I'm seeing that things that I'm doing online, like, have an effect on my life, and what I say to other people has an effect. And so I think, as the internet sort of continues to evolve to be more intimately connected to us, we'll sort of start to think differently about how we act there and how weird we end up being.
Yeah, interesting call, Richard. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Danielle, do you see this as sort of part of this learning curve as this new technology is evolving so rapidly? And obviously, we're so connected to it.
I think that's exactly right, that we are, you know, it's not the internet in bold letters that what this is sort of exceptional space. We now sort of account for the fact that it's all real life, that these technologies, as Amanda says, are with us. They're integral to the work that we do, to our socializing. You know, they're platforms that aren't just pure speech platforms. They're multifaceted. They're integral to what we do every day. And I think we are trying to catch up and learn how to use them in ways that are socially productive. And, you know, it's refreshing to hear Richard's candor. And Sports Illustrated writer, Jeff Perlman, was saying that he is amazed by the kinds of comments that he got sort of pre-internet from his readers and post, that they were incredibly, like, destructive and scary, you know, post-internet. And he wrote and tracked down to some of his commenters. And when he did, he sort of found out who Matt and Andy were, you know, these sort of folks who on Twitter were sending him these, like, horrific images and really destructive and frightening comments. When he actually found out who they were and called them on the phone, the reaction from both of them when they said, "Oh, we're so embarrassed. We can't believe the internet got to us, right? That we are horrified by what we did, and we would take it back in a heartbeat." And I think that's what Richard experienced is common, and increasingly, you know, this kind of generation of, certainly for my kids or teenagers growing up with these technologies, they're much savvier, I think. And as long as we're having those conversations with younger people and with our peers about ways in which we can lose ourselves, right, and we have to remind ourselves about our humanity and bring it back into the way we think, I think is an important struggle for all of us.
I mean, that reminds me, I have to say, of the Twinkie defense. I mean, it's almost like, you know, the internet made me do it, Danielle. It's the internet's fault.
Beautifully said, right? No, people say that all the time. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah. Amanda, anything you want to add to that?
I did sort of find something interesting in the course of my reporting, which concerned a woman in the UK who was receiving just an enormous number of rape and death threats over Twitter when she suggested that her government put more female faces on the currency. So it seems like a pretty modest proposal from her. She just got vitriol from, you know, so many named and anonymous people. And I found that it was interesting that when a few people were actually arrested for threatening her, one was someone who was your typical, you know, Reddit troll type of guy, who was sort of a computer programmer who was into some sort of trolling culture. And another was just a normal woman who said, you know, obviously I don't hate women. I am one. And yet, you know, when I sort of got caught up in this mob mentality, I used the language that they use, which is sexist and violent, against this other woman. And I'm sorry, and I'm not sure exactly why I did that. So, you can sort of see people using the internet in revolutionary ways, and sometimes that's a positive thing and sometimes it's negative.
Indeed. But let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about online harassment, revenge porn, the rights, responsibilities, and protections on the internet. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show has brought together patrons and artisans for 20 years. This year's show takes place at the 23rd Street Armory just north of Chestnut Street and runs from Friday evening, April 4th to Sunday the 6th. Featuring modern and traditional tables, chairs, beds, textiles, lighting, and tabletop items. PIFS supports WHYY. Info at philaifs.com. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show. Art you can live with.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. If you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes on our show, here's your chance to find out. On a special Fresh Air broadcast, Friday, March 28th, our producers and I will answer your questions about how we put the show together. To submit your questions, go to the website whyy.org/askfreshair. That's whyy.org/askfreshair. So tell us what you want to know, then tune in March 28th.
From the eve of something that changed everything to the eve of what exactly? 100 years ago, in the spring of 1914, what did the world imagine was about to happen? World War I changed everything. A bloody conflict the great powers just wandered into. Where are we wandering today? Echoes and lessons for 2014 from 1914. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about online harassment. It has become a worrisome problem, especially for women who say they have received death threats and rape threats and other violent and degrading messages. Should they dismiss them as the price of using social media or take them more seriously by reporting them? And as it turns out, it's often easier said than done because not all companies or law enforcement take cyber threats seriously. What do you think? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, talking with Amanda Hess, staff writer at Slate, and Danielle Citron, professor of law at the University of Maryland. We have an email, and I'll toss this to you, Danielle. Can they discuss the pros and cons of establishing something like a national cyber crime unit? That's an email from Linus. Would that go towards dealing with what we've been talking about?
I mean, in some respect, we have that. There are, you know, within the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI, you know, cybercrime units. So we certainly have the capability and on the ground people devoted to cybercrime, but it's not a top priority, certainly. There is a federal cyberstalking law that can cover precisely the kind of abuse that Amanda faced. But, you know, when victims go to law enforcement, federal law enforcement, because that's what Linus was suggesting, right, like a national cybercrime center, you know, you go to federal authorities and the FBI often tell victims, it's not national security, nothing we can do for you. But there are, Congress has so legislated in this space since 2006, but yet these laws are really heavily under-enforced.
Amanda, I have an email for you from an anonymous writer. I've been stalked by an ex-boyfriend since February 2011. I'm self-employed and a freelance writer, which requires me to be actively engaged in social media. Each visit to the police ended with them simply telling me to go offline for 3 years, all social media, all email. This is beyond ridiculous and not possible. I have been limited in how much I can expand my business online because he's always there to intimidate me with potential reactions. Thanks for the program. I finally feel vindicated. And I'm wondering, since you've been writing about this, Amanda, whether you're finding others who are sharing some of their same stories and problems.
Yeah, I hear from women who have similar issues all the time. People who are dealing with a sort of breadth of harassment and a form of personal harassment that is much more extreme than anything that I've ever dealt with. And it's very sad, and I wish I could sort of tell them, you know, what to do. I know that Danielle sort of has a better grasp on whether there are any other avenues that they can sort of investigate. But I think it has been helpful for women to know that it's not, you know, their personal problem and that going off the internet is not a reasonable solution and that they're not alone. I know that that's sort of small comfort sometimes, but I've definitely heard from dozens and dozens of women with similar stories.
Danielle, is this a civil rights issue?
I mean, I think it absolutely is. What we're seeing is the sort of silencing and exclusion of women from crucial kind of economic opportunities and life opportunities. And that's how we think of, you know, what is civil rights? What's our tradition all about? You know, that tradition is about ensuring that we have equality of opportunity in sort of key avenues, whether it's work, you know, speech, engagement in education, and it's precisely these kinds of opportunities that are being systematically denied women in ways that are clearly gendered and sexually demeaning, and they are depriving them of, you know, just as the woman who wrote, the anonymous person who wrote in, depriving her of the chance to, you know, basically make a living and pursue her business because the stalker will constantly undermine, terrify, surveil, and frighten her.
I have another email. My daughter and her friends have taken the route of anonymizing their online presences. They create drop-dead email accounts for the purposes of using social media. Their other social media accounts, they don't reveal their true information about themselves. And whenever possible, they fictionalize, obscure, or negate age, location, and gender. I'll put this to you, Amanda Hess. I mean, is that one way to protect oneself, or does that feel like it's asking too much of the potential victim?
I sort of feel both ways about it. I mean, I think on the one hand, younger people who are sort of growing up with these technologies just sort of inherently know the risks of using them, and that can sort of be a positive thing and a negative thing. But, you know, it's interesting that, like, when teenagers use Facebook, they will log on to Facebook, and then they'll delete their account when they log out of it so that no one else can see it, and then when they want to use it again, they'll just reactivate it. Like, things I never would have thought of. And so I think that's very interesting, and it can be really helpful for individuals. I'm not sure that sort of telling victims what to do is what we should be doing from a policy perspective. But surely, you know, it can be very empowering to use social media in the way that makes the most sense for you and sort of protects your information and only sort of connects you with the people that you want to be connected with.
But what you're saying is the focus should be on the perpetrators, not the people that are trying to navigate around potential perpetrators.
Right, right.
I wonder to you, Danielle, I mean, should we think, is Twitter different from Facebook? I mean, Twitter, I guess, is a bit more anonymous than Facebook. Do I have that right?
It could be. It's true that Facebook requires you to use your real names. And Twitter, you absolutely can, you know, assume a handle that, you know, it's anonymized and you can't figure out who you are, at least to the person viewing it.
Right.
But I want to, if it's okay, kind of return,
yeah, please.
You know, to the former point about this kind of suggestion that people kind of cover who they are to assume male identities or to pretend they're something they're not. And that sort of demonstrates, at least for me, why this absolutely is a civil rights problem. That is the insistence that people deny their identity and can't perform their identity, let's say, as a woman, and they have to cover who they are, is identity denying, right? So that it's, you know, it's depriving someone of the chance to kind of perform who they are in a way that they don't have to be ashamed of. To me, it sort of demonstrates precisely why this is a deprival of, you know, deprivation of someone's equality and a chance to just perform their identity and who they are without having to be ashamed and worried about being attacked. Sorry to divert us. But
no, that's okay.
To return to your question about, you know, the kind of abuse that we see on these different platforms, you know, a company like Facebook, I sort of see them as kind of virtuous sort of intermediary. They have kind of four safety offices across the globe. They have over 400 people on their safety teams working really hard to create a culture of respect on their sites. It's imperfect, of course, because of their scale, right? They have like more than 1 billion and 0.2 users. But the effort is there to create communities of respect, and they have kind of an open dialogue with the public about what they expect of their users in their terms of service agreements and community guidelines, and in turn kind of providing a transparency about, you know, their expectations for their users. And some sites are less, you know, it's not a priority for them. Twitter had, I think, a really important response to the case that, you know, Amanda talked about in Britain, where the threats, you know, persistent threats, not only to the woman who is advocating for, you know, basically it was political advocacy,
exactly,
facing bomb and rape and death threats, so were politicians. And Twitter changed its policy and adopted an abuse, you could report abuse and block people. And so that was new for Twitter. And so I've been working on revenge porn legislation, and I've been sort of harassed on Twitter by folks who were not happy with my position, and I block them. So it's been a really helpful way so that I can sustain my interest in use of Twitter as a platform without having to be inundated with tweets that threaten me. And I know that, Amanda, you know, it would be interesting, your experience with Twitter was disappointing. So it's not that there's perfect responses all the time.
Indeed. Amanda, anything you want to add to that? And then we'll get back to our callers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these companies can do better or worse by their policies. I am a little bit skeptical that, you know, our rights might be sort of in the hands of these billion-dollar companies that are really sort of set up to encourage us to speak publicly. And I'm not sure that their priorities are our priorities. But at the same time, they have all of this money and they have some accountability to their users, whereas local police departments have no money and, you know, at least in my case, seemingly no accountability. So it is sort of difficult to know who to turn to really sort of change this environment.
We are talking about what to do about online harassment. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Amanda, I'm looking at a piece that Jim Pagels wrote. You probably saw this. His description of these people who are threatening people, yourself, others, largely women online, is that they are toothless, and that the idea is you just ignore them, just don't pay them any mind. And I'm assuming that probably makes sense in some circumstances, but what do you think about a response like that to what you and others have been writing about?
I think it's uninformed. You know, we talk a lot about sort of the coarse language on the internet, and I think for a lot of people who were sort of on the ground floor in internet communities, most of whom were men, this was sort of this Wild West type of place that they wanted to create for themselves. I sort of see it as like a libertarian kind of community where they can say whatever they want and it's not like politically correct or what have you. And I think so, you know, for someone like Jim to come and say, this is just the way that the internet is, don't worry about it. It's really just sort of, you know, it's reinforcing the status quo that was not really built by women and it was not built for women. And it doesn't come with any understanding of the experiences that women have. So I think it's a sort of very narrow approach to the problem.
We have an email, or actually I guess it was a caller, couldn't say, on Matthew from Wilmington. Do they take into account that some men might be lying about online harassment? And does that matter, I guess, to you, Danielle Citron? If someone is, let's say, is threatening somebody, but they don't mean it, does that somehow mitigate the situation?
You know, it might just legally make a difference, right? So that in some jurisdictions, in the way we've interpreted and understand threats, that if there's not a subjective intent to put someone in fear of physical harm, then they may not be criminally responsible. But of course, the net effect, right, for victims is it's terrifying. It can change the way they live their lives. You know, I've talked to victims about how they've moved. They've, like, put in installed alarm systems, are afraid to go out by themselves at night, so that it has a meaningful impact. It has the impact of a true threat. And in some jurisdictions, if a reasonable person would take it as a true threat, then it's a true threat and it's criminal activity. So I think to write it off as it's a joke, I didn't mean it,
right,
is to completely trivialize the way in which it has such powerful impacts on victims.
Let me get, looks like Katie from Garnet Valley to join us on Radio Times. Katie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, thank you. Basically, I just want to make a comment about the idea of the policies that are in place on Twitter and Facebook and other social media platforms. I think that the idea of just simply reporting somebody or blocking them, like, as a final solution to the problem really isn't ever going to be enough, because they could just simply, you know, just make a new email account and just make a new account with that email. And I think that, unfortunately, I think that the problem is more complex than just simply reporting somebody and blocking them on Facebook or on Twitter, because, I mean, it really is an anonymous, you know, platform that somebody can just as easily just make a new account.
And so
it's a more complex issue.
No, I agree with you, Kate, but are you saying that we can't do anything about it?
I don't think that we can't do anything about it. I think that maybe there just needs to be more policies in place. I don't know if that's some place for the police to get involved. I think that a lot of issues like HIPAA and SOPA get involved, where people think that they need more internet security and that would be infringing on it. So I think it's just a really complex issue, and I'm not sure that there is one simple answer to solve all for the problem, really.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Amanda, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree, and I think that this sort of impulse to just delete these comments or to ban the anonymous user can sort of work, you know, in between technology and companies and police attitudes to really sort of dismiss victims. So in my case, someone contacted Twitter on my behalf to alert them to this Twitter account that was set up to threaten me. And Twitter didn't contact me. They suspended the person's account, so all of those tweets that they made were deleted sort of from public view. And the end result of that was there was a real human who made those statements. He happened to make them on Twitter. But after Twitter deleted them, Twitter can sort of wash their hands of it. They feel like they've done, you know, everything in their power to shut it down. And for police, you know, to people who don't understand this problem, to them it looks like the problem is gone. The threats aren't there anymore. And the fact is that there's still someone who committed, you know, what may be a crime, who was not investigated because police just sort of see it as, you know, a weird thing that someone did in a strange place they don't understand. And when the evidence is gone, they sort of see the problem as resolved.
Danielle, I'm going to give you the final 30 seconds. What are your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. So I think that's absolutely right that, you know, it's not a one sort of avenue of how we address this, that as I explore in my book, that it's law, it's social norms, it's intermediaries, parents, and schools. This is a really hard problem, and there's a lot of deep thought that needs to come from a lot of different directions. So intermediaries is one small response, but it has to be a concerted effort.
Well, we could go on. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Amanda Hess, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And she's a staff writer at Slate, joined us from the studios of Slate. Danielle Citrin, thank you very much as well.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
You're very welcome. And she's a professor of law at the University of Maryland, the Francis King Carey School of Law. And her book, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, is coming out this summer, published by Harvard University Press. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our homepage. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter, and of course, download podcasts as well, and much, much more. WHYY.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.